Hi, everybody. This is Atrevida, and you are listening to Conversations on a Tightrope. This show will be the first of five shows on atheism. Tonight, the one will be Colin McGinn. And I do want to tell you that I strive for clarity on this show, clarity of thought, clarity of belief, and clarity of information and intent. I did schedule a co-host who had to cancel due to a work commitment, so I dug deep, I mean real deep, down to the bones to find another co-host so that I could discuss this extremely serious philosophical issue with someone. And I must say that I did come up with someone, and I think maybe I would like to introduce him. So let him introduce himself.
My name is Jeff Peterson.
Okay, sorry about that. Jeff was a little slow, but let me tell you who Jeff is. For those of you who have never heard of Jeff Peterson, he is the co-host of the Late Late Night talk show host Craig Ferguson. I hope Craig doesn't mind that I stole him away for a short while. I have the deepest respect for Craig's show. Since I suffer from insomnia, I am up from 12:30 a.m. to 1:30 a.m. watching Craig on TV on CBS and feel a certain kindred spirit with him in regard to his broadcast. Is anyone listening or viewing, and why? Well, Craig is very funny, and if you can't sleep, you may as well laugh. And in my case, who knows why you might be listening to my show? I hope it's because you will be hearing about some interesting ideas, people, etc. Also, Craig is the only talk show host that has a co-host who is a robot skeleton. In other words, he's dead. However, I found him on Facebook and YouTube, and he is quite entertaining and irresistible. So why don't I ask him a question here? Jeff, do you think that I gave a fair description of who you are?
Mr. Skeleton agrees.
Well, that's good to hear. Do you think, Jeff, that Craig Ferguson will be angry with you or me for coming on my show?
No.
Oh, great. I did hear Craig ask you about where you live sometimes. So for WGXC listeners, could you tell us where that is?
Welcome to my place in New Hampshire. Go there at least once a year. Get a little pad down there. Just come down sometime. We go fishing and we throw beads at people. We take our clothes off, go swimming.
Wow. Sounds like fun, Jeff, and I'd love to visit there someday. But now we're going to listen to the first 10 minutes of the BBC, British Broadcasting Corporation, 2004 Jonathan Miller interview with the English philosopher Colin McGinn on why he is an atheist. I'm going to read a brief intro about Colin McGinn and then play the BBC audio. Are you interested in hearing it, Jeff?
Oh, yeah. Oh, hell yeah.
Well, then. Okay, then. Let me read a little bit. This was taken from Bill Moyer's webpage, who also interviewed Colin McGinn. He's a British philosopher whose work focuses on philosophy of mind, ethics, and philosophical logic. He currently teaches at the University of Miami. McGinn is perhaps best known as a philosopher for championing the new Mysterianism, a theory that human consciousness can never be explained because the mind is fundamentally incapable of comprehending itself fully. In his groundbreaking book on the subject, The Mysterious Flame, Conscious Minds in a Material World, McGinn argues that humans can still take solace in this inexplicable mystery because by acknowledging our limitations, we are then free to explore other areas of human intelligence that are open to our understanding. So, in addition to his academic publications, McGinn has written widely on philosophy and philosophers for a lay audience in such publications as the New York Review of Books, the London Review of Books, the New Republic, and the New York Times Book Review. I also see that his best known and perhaps most accessible book is his autobiography, The Making of a Philosopher, My Journey Through 20th Century Philosophy. In it, he charts his intellectual evolution from his boyhood in a poor mining family in Northeast England to his studies at Oxford University and ultimately to his career in academia as a professional philosopher. Along the way, he offers portraits of some of the great philosophers of the 20th century, including Jean-Paul Sartre, Bertrand Russell, and A.J. Iyer. McGinn is currently writing a book on Shakespeare that is due out in the fall of 2006. So why don't I start this here clip? I am going to interrupt it about 10 minutes into it, so it'll be the first 10 minutes, and then maybe we can discuss a little bit about what Colin McGinn told Jonathan Miller. Let's try this now.
In the summer of 2003, I began filming the series Atheism, A Rough History of Disbelief. As part of the process, I talked to a number of writers, scientists, historians, and philosophers. Having secured their cooperation, I was very embarrassed to find that a large proportion of what went on ended up on the cutting room floor, simply because the series would have lasted 24 hours otherwise. Well, as it happens, the BBC agreed with me that the conversations were too interesting to be junk. They've made the extremely unusual decision to go back to the original material and to broadcast at length some of the conversations which I had. Conversations with people such as the English biologist Richard Dawkins, the American philosopher Daniel Dennett, the Cambridge theologian Dennis Turner, the American playwright Arthur Miller, the English philosopher Colin McGinn, and the American Nobel Prize-winning physicist, Steven Weinberg. Colin McGinn, at his apartment in New York, we discussed at some length the meaning of the word belief. And much of that discussion is in the Atheism series. But to begin with, I just wanted to get from Colin a sense of what it felt like to be a skeptical English philosopher in a country as seemingly religious as the United States.
Sometimes Americans will say, so you don't believe in God? And I say, that's right, I don't believe in God.
And they say, so do you believe in anything?
Oh, yes.
Do you believe in anything? And I say, I believe in many things, and I don't make jokes to them about I believe in tables and chairs. And I say to them, you know, I believe in various ethical causes and political ideas and other aesthetic values, intellectual values, lots of things that I believe in. And they say, that's all you believe in. I say, that's all I believe in. Don't you believe in something God-like? You don't believe in the traditional God. Don't you believe there's something there? And I say, no, there's nothing there. And it's very difficult to get across to people who are religious, when you're an atheist, you mean you don't believe in anything like that whatsoever.
Mm.
It's not that you think nature is God, or it doesn't have personal qualities, or something like that. You don't believe in anything of that type. And if nothing supernatural, nothing miraculous, nothing superstitious, no ghosts, no telepathy, you know, nothing of that kind. That's what it's to do with. It's not that I'm picking on God, you know, somehow, or picking on the Christian God and not believing in him.
Mm.
It's just nothing of that type.
And that's what you've got to do. Then get the answer, which I get from people who are not necessarily religious. I mean, they don't belong to either or any of the three monotheistic religions. They will say, not just simply, there must be something, to which I would give the same reply as you. But where do you get your spirituality? Otherwise, there's a shortage of some sort. But I've never been able to get from them whether it's like some vitamin deficiency.
Exactly. What do they mean by that? Can an atheist be spiritual? I guess it's a matter of definition, really. I mean, it certainly can't be if it connotes anything supernatural, but, you know, aesthetic and ethical values can approximate to what people call the spirit. You know, your most deeply held beliefs about human behaviour might be counted as spiritual, I don't know. Your feelings about nature, I suppose, might be. I mean, I wouldn't use the word. It doesn't seem to me to be a good word to use, a risky word to use, but it doesn't mean you don't have, you know, any deep views about things, you know, or deep convictions about things.
Well, but that's where I always say the clergyman crouching in the laurel bushes leaps out and says, your deep feelings are, in fact, unacknowledged acknowledgements. of the God you deny.
Yeah, well, one of my deep feelings is that there is no God, and it's a bad idea to believe in God, and it's been very harmful.
So that reflects my belief in God. Well, that's a strange situation. That's one of my deepest convictions, is there is no God.
Now, I happen to share Colin's conviction that there is no God. And in my case, I never believed it. So I wondered if there had ever been a time in Colin's earlier life when he did believe in God.
Well, with me, it was actually quite
precisely delineated. It was, I can't remember the exact dates now, you know, the exact times, but I think I was about 17 or 18 when the idea of believing in God, and it was Christianity that I was exposed to, became real to me. And it went on for about a year, I would say. Not much more than that. If you'd said to me when I was 10, "What, do you believe in God?" I probably would have said yes, I don't know. But it didn't mean anything. It was just sort of, you know, everybody does, don't they? I mean, it's like the cows, you know, everybody believes in them. But then I actually started studying the Bible, because I was studying divinity A-level. So I started studying it, but we had a very charismatic teacher, an admirable man, Mr. Marsh, who I wrote about in my autobiography, who was very enthusiastic, and he was teaching us the Bible, and I was having to learn the Bible, studying it closely, you know, it's like Old Testament, New Testament. So I know much more about the New Testament than most Christians now, and I, even now, 25 years later, I know more about it than most religious people. So I actually know it pretty well. It's what got me interested in philosophy, because at the same time I was getting interested in philosophy, it was through thinking about religion, studying the Bible. And I think there were two factors, confluence of two factors here. One was the interest in metaphysical questions, basic questions about the universe. How, you know, what's it all about? What does it all mean? That kind of question. And on the other hand, there was an ethical component to it, because you find in the New Testament, obviously, a very strong emphasis on ethical aspects of life. I was an idealistic teenager, you know, and it was the 60s, so that had a profound impact on me, the ethical side. And I was not brought up in a house where ethical ideas were particularly discussed or, you know, and it still has a profound impact on me, the ethical side of it. So those two things, I think, made me think there was more to life than the mundane realities that I'd been used to, living up there in Blackpool, you know, with the amusement arcades and the pubs and fish and chip shops, you know, and the freezing cold. And there was this idea of philosophical thought, metaphysical ideas, and then these high ethical ideals. A good combination, right? A good combination. So I got interested in it, and so for a period I was influenced by that. And I went to university studying psychology, and since I stopped studying the Bible, I wasn't seeing Mr. Marsh anymore for our divinity lessons. I kept it up a bit, and then occasionally would talk to people about religion, and it just sort of disappeared. And I remember going out, I remember sort of trying hard to keep up with it, going to some sort of religious meeting, and I just was sitting listening, and I thought, this is a load of rubbish. I just don't think this is true anymore. And then I was reading Bertrand Russell, Why I'm Not a Christian. And in a few matters, I don't remember the details, but in a pretty short time, I just decided it was all wrong. But and I also decided you could keep the ethical side and the philosophical side and jettison the rest. So Russell represented to me an alternative to religious idealism. It was a more, you know, it was a secular idealism. So I realized you could have some of the aspects of religion which appealed to me, you could have without religion. And the bits that didn't appeal to me, like, you know, the virgin birth, miracles, strange ideas about how the universe came around, the sort of bits that's very hard to believe, you could just cut those bits off and you could keep the good bits. So you get rid of the theological baggage of religion, and then you keep the sides of it that you like. And that's what I have ever done ever since. Basically the same thing.
Was there any crisis in, as it were, unhitching the metaphysical and divine from the ethical to which you continue
not,
to
not
subscribe.
In my case, which is I think it differs from other people's case. In Russell's own description of his fall from theism, he describes it as a deeply painful, traumatic, irrecoverable episode. He spent his whole life somehow dealing with it. Not with me. It was relatively easy. It just happened quite naturally. As I say in my autobiography, it's like shedding the skin when, you know, the skin comes off and you have a new skin, and it seems fine.
Was there a sense of relief as you shed the skin?
No, I wouldn't say there was relief. I think there was disappointment.
Oh.
I would have liked religion to be...
All right, I'm taking a break right there, because Colin McGinn says a whole bunch of things, and One of I found very interesting when he started it is how because he says he doesn't believe in a traditional God, people ask him, don't you believe there's something there? And basically he says, no, there's nothing there. And people just don't understand how you can go through life and feel that there is nothing out there that is sort of, I guess, taking care of you. I thought about that, and I came up with the way I believe that many of us humans, to propose to others, I think what it is I believe that fundamentalist religious believers of any faith really are psychologically and emotionally fragile people. They cannot even contemplate the possibility that there is only nothingness, and to nothingness we will return when we die. My point of view, that's what makes people a little bit uncomfortable, because everybody wants to, it's easier, I think, to go through life having that kind of belief. It's comforting. And he goes on to even talk about that. He goes on, I'll continue, and you'll hear him say why he was a bit disappointed in his in the way it is. So let me continue.
True. I'd like it to be true, because I'd like there to be immortality. I'd like there to be rewards for those who've been virtuous and punishments for those who've not been virtuous. Especially the punishments would be good. You know, there's no justice in this world, and it would be good if there was some cosmic force that distributed justice in the proper way that it should be. And it still is, to me, a constant source of irritation and pain that wicked people prosper and virtuous people don't. So there was a bit of disappointment about those aspects of it. But there was some exhilaration too. I mean, Russell has a description which I think is kind of appropriate of a feeling of a godless universe is a kind of exhilarating universe. There's something hygienic about it. There's something bracing about it. Whereas the idea that there's this sort of suffocating presence gazing at your every movement and thought, you know, it's a bit oppressive to think that way.
Okay, now here you are, the philosopher that you thought you might become.
Yeah.
You have now very fully become. Now, in your role as a philosopher, I'd love you to develop the arguments which were previously simply intuitional skin shedding.
Yeah.
Now be more systematic and surgical about it, and say why, in fact, the notion of a god.
Well,
incredible.
The one set of arguments is the sort of no evidence arguments. Russell puts it by saying, there's no more reason to believe in the Christian God than the Greek gods. No more reason to believe. In other words, there's no positive evidence for it. I mean, there's no theory that you need to postulate God in to explain some natural phenomenon, which can't be explained by some other theory. People say, sometimes will say, well, miracles were performed. There's never any good evidence that miracles were performed. The judgment that they were is usually based on a prior opinion that God exists, rather than being an independent source for believing that God exists. So there's no evidence in terms of what anybody's ever observed. There's no fact about the world that can't be explained without postulating God. So there's no reason to believe in God, any more than there's any reason to believe in Zeus or any of the Greek gods. So that's on the side of whether there's any reason to believe it. There's the question now, are there reasons to disbelieve it? And any positive arguments against it?
Mm.
There are also some arguments for, like the ontological argument. When we talk about the ontological argument.
Well, tell us what that argument is.
The ontological argument. This is a very nice argument. Anselm of Canterbury thought of it. I think it must be in the 15th century. He argued that the definition of God entails that God exists. Now, this would be a fantastic result, right, if that... Just the mere definition tells that God exists. So, what's the definition of God? The most perfect conceivable being, or let's say the most powerful conceivable being is an equally good way of putting it. And then Anselm argues as follows. Well, suppose this most powerful or most perfect being did not exist. Then he would lack the attribute of existence. But the attribute of existence is one of the perfections, one of the things which makes a being powerful. But since he is, by definition, the most perfect being, he must have the attribute of existence. Therefore, God exists. So let's go over the argument again. Get the definition of God. How is God to be defined? Let's compare this with the unicorn. Well, how is a unicorn to be defined? A unicorn is a horse with a horn growing out of the middle of its head. There's nothing in that definition to imply that unicorns exist and unicorns don't exist. But let's define God, right? An all-powerful, all-good, all-knowing being. Right? These are some of his characteristics. And everybody will agree that's the definition of God. So now one of the definitions is he's the most perfect being. One of his attributes is utmost perfection, unimprovable perfection. Okay, that's the definition of God. Now Anselm argues, but if God didn't exist, wouldn't he be less perfect than a being just like him in all those attributes except that that being existed? Because to exist is to be more perfect than not to exist. It's better to exist than not to exist. God is as good as you can be, as superior as you can be, so he must exist. So we know by definition that God exists. It's a brilliant argument, right? But it's wholly unconvincing to everybody who hears it. They think there's something going wrong with that, you know. That's a very strange argument.
All right, tell us what's wrong.
Well, the difficulty is nobody's ever managed to pinpoint exactly what's wrong with it. I'll tell you what I think is wrong with it. Mm. Though the issue is not by no means clear. I think what's very funny in the bit that goes, science strikes you as sophistical, is the bit that says, God's the most perfect. Existence is one of the perfections. It sounds superficially plausible, but what does it really mean, right? It's one of the perfections. I like to compare this to somebody who said, let's take the most tasty meal that conceivable. Mm. The most tasty meal conceivable. Does that mean anything to say that? This is the most tasty meal I've ever had, but it's not well defined, the most tasty meal conceivable, or, you know, the best football game conceivable. Not the way I've ever seen. What does it mean then? I mean, it's not a very clearly meaningful idea. So if we say we're defining God as the most perfect being, and we don't really lay down very clearly what we mean by perfect, then what does it really mean, the most perfect being? You know, he doesn't have the most perfect colours, because he's not coloured at all. You know, what is it? It's not clear what it means. So we can't always think that phrases like the most perfect conceivable F are always meaningful. Sometimes they are meaningful. The most perfect conceivable triangle. It means one whose angles are precisely 180 degrees. But the most perfect conceivable moral being, what does that mean? It's not clear that it's so well defined.
So that's what I think is wrong with it. But it's like many a philosophical argument. Just because you can't refute it, it doesn't mean you should take it all that seriously, especially if, you know, form your common sense beliefs on the basis of it.
All right, so much for the ontological.
Yes, right, that's the ontological argument.
Now, how about the other ones?
Well, here's one I like. People think, I think psychologically this
is quite important to people. That's why this argument is probably more important psychologically. People think, without God, life is meaningless. Where is meaning? Right? It's just an empty charade of, you know, pointless and purposeless, valueless, going from one thing to the next. Well, the first reply to make to that is, you don't necessarily need to seek the meaning of life outside of life. Here's the premise, the assumption of that argument. Without there being a being outside of human life would have no meaning. So the meaning of human life must be conferred by another being. Here's my question. What gives the meaning to that being's life? Right? How does his life, God's life, derive meaning? Well, here's a dilemma, right? Either God's life has meaning intrinsically just by his existence, or not, right? Well, if it does, then it's possible to have a meaningful life intrinsically. So why can't our lives have intrinsic meaning? They don't need to have their meaning conferred by another being.
But the religious might want to argue, without even reverting to the ontological proof of the existence of God, that the fact, the observable fact, that we do have values and meanings, mm-hmm. is in fact evidence of the fact that something has given the meanings, in the same way that the argument from design says something has given the thing design.
Yeah. Well, there's two. I think there are two points there. One point is that the existence of values itself is an argument for the existence of God, like an evidence argument. Mm. Another point, though, altogether, is the idea that morality can only have a foundation if it's based on God's commands or God's desires, God's wishes. Right. Now, you started with the first one, of course. The thing to say about that is there's just no reason to think that the existence of values in human society depends on the existence of God. I mean, why should it? There's just no clear logical argument for one thing. Any more than the existence of ears, you know, is a reason. I mean, there are various aspects of human life. There's art, there's value, there's family, there are all sorts of things that we take to be valuable. Why does any of these require that we postulate God to explain their existence? A more worrying question for many people is they don't see that morality can have any foundation, can have any absoluteness, unless there's a God to certify it, legitimate it. That's a, you know, that's a, you can see that at that point. It's a point that was discussed by Plato long ago in the Euthyphro argument. And he makes, well, I think Socrates makes a completely compelling case, a refutation of that argument. And it simply goes as follows. The argument, you see, goes like this. So, suppose you take as a moral principle, it's wrong to steal. Why is, people say, now, why is that wrong? Why is it wrong to steal? Answer, because God says it's wrong to steal. God commanded that you should not steal. Okay. The point that Socrates makes in that dialogue is to say, well, how can God give this moral rule a foundation? Either the moral rule is itself intrinsically a sound moral rule, or it can't be given soundness and legitimacy from an external command. Suppose, for example, we had the rule, it's right to murder. And somebody said, that's not right. Murder is wrong. And somebody said in reply, but God says it's right to murder. That doesn't convince you that it's right to murder. If God says that something is right which isn't right, God's wrong. Right? He can't make something right just by saying it's right. God can only, what God has to do is reflect what's right in his commandments. So that's what he really does. It is wrong to steal, wrong to steal and wrong to murder. So God says it's wrong. And he's right to say that. Why? Because it is wrong in the two cases. He doesn't make it wrong by saying it. He can't do that. If that was so, we'd have no reason to respect God's morality.
And that is God, as it were, appropriates our spontaneous and indigenous values, which then get, as it were, reflected back upon this hypothetical entity, which then seems to validate our beliefs.
Exactly. So we don't need God to validate our moral beliefs. He couldn't validate them. His validations only work in as much as they correspond to what is morally right and is morally wrong. He can't make something be morally right when it's not. Another way to put it is, it can't be a matter of God's free decision or whim what's right and wrong. Know what they ought to do. But human beings are weak. We're weak. We have weakness of the will. We don't always do what we know very well we ought to do. And that is, in most people, produces the phenomenon of guilt. Guilt is a powerful negative force in people's minds. People hate guilt, right? Guilt is a bad feeling. So you need something to prevent guilt. To prevent guilt, you need something to make you do what you know is right. But since human beings are weak, they don't always do what they know is right. But God gives you an extra motive to do what's right, beyond morality itself. Morality gives you a motive, but it's a motive which is rather fragile, rather, you know, momentary, intermittent, and easily broken. But if you've got the idea of God there, it can sort of give it some more oomph, gives it more power. And then you can do what you know is right more easily, more regularly. And that's, you know, perfectly sensible. That's why, you know, it's not unreasonable anyway for an atheist to think that maybe we need God, or people need God, because without God they can't do what they know is right. You know, and I don't believe that myself. I think people are not as morally depraved as the religious tradition says. I think most people will do what's right in normal conditions. They won't always, of course, but normally they will. They don't need God. And I think people who sometimes have lived with God as their moral support, their moral whatever it is that they're getting from it, when they cease to believe in God, they feel that it was not as difficult to be moral afterwards as they suspected it might be. And in fact, it was better, because there's a corrupting part to that conception of God, which is the idea that you're doing something good because God will reward you and think well of you. And that's a corrupting idea. It's much better to do what's good because it's good, and only because it's good. That's your only reason for doing it. But the idea you're going to get the warm, fuzzy feeling, oh, God's really pleased with me today, you know, I did this, that's not what morality ought to be about.
Okay, I wanted to stop there because that's something I often think about, the fact that people who believe that, oh, this is the right thing to do, and really think that if they live that way, they will go to heaven. And I agree with Colin McGinn. I mean, that isn't a morally right way to believe. It should be something you feel intrinsically is the right thing to do, not because you're going to get something because you did the right thing, because you're going to be on the good side of God. So that's something I found rather interesting. And he also said that human beings are weak. I have to agree with him. I think we all agree with him on that. That's why even atheists seem to be much more more understanding in why people sometimes need to believe in something, that they can't believe in nothingness, because they are weak. And some people just really need that support. So it's not that atheists don't feel that way about it. I think they're rather magnanimous, since they, especially Colin McGinn, since he says that he is an anti-theist, not just an atheist. He still, when we come further on, I think he will say what he would do for the freedom of people believing in what they want to believe. But let me go on.
Discuss the various arguments that have been offered in favor of the existence of God. I asked Colin to summarize some of the best reasons for not believing.
Well, the classic argument against is the problem of evil. This is, even religious people find this one very uncomfortable.
So the argument is simply, God is meant to be a being who is all-knowing, all-powerful, and all-good. So how come there is suffering and pain in the world? Why does God allow it? God, obviously, if he's all-good, thinks it's bad that this should occur, would rather it didn't occur, right? Like any decent person would rather it didn't occur, and yet he lets it occur. Now, that would be okay if he didn't have the power to change it, but he's meant to be all-powerful. I mean, we're told by religious people he intervenes all the time in various ways. So why doesn't he intervene to prevent the death of a child, you know, or the torture of a prisoner? He doesn't do it. So you don't want to conclude from that, well, God is actually quite bad, quite a bad person. That's a conceivable conclusion you might draw. But what you conclude from it is the combination of these two characteristics is inconsistent. He's all good and he's all powerful. You need all knowing too, of course, because he has to know what's going on. But it's essentially the conflict between being all good and all powerful and the existence of evil. And the standard reply to that, the apologists of religion will give the reply, God created human beings with free will. Now, there's a question, why did he do that, knowing the results were going to be horrific? Right? That was a pretty wicked thing to do, to start with. But let's put that one aside. But the problem with that argument is not all of the suffering in the world comes from the exercise of human will. Much of it comes from natural catastrophes or disease, accidents, and all sorts of things can cause tremendous suffering in humans. They, you know, somebody's born with a genetic disease. No human being had any role whatsoever in creating that. That comes from nature, God's creation, of course, we're told. So God created a world in which it was inevitable there'd be tremendous suffering on the part of completely innocent human beings.
But there might be religious arguments to the effect that he created this obstacle course for his created creatures endowed with free will in order to bring out the best in them.
And I always find this one, to me, it brings out to me the sort of hard-hearted, immoral side of this way of thinking about things. Because just think about what's being said when somebody says that. You've got the innocent child with some terrible disease, and God's up there saying to himself, I really need to test some people here. They need to put the obstacle course needs to be put there. Let me pick on this little 2-year-old girl, put her through this terrible ordeal, and I'll test the other people. I mean, if any human being said to you that's what they'd done, suppose I decided in my wisdom, I need to test some people here. I need to improve their moral characters. So I'm going to do this terrible thing to their child, you know. You'd think I was the wickedest person in the world to do that. Well, why isn't God? If that's what God does, I have no respect for him. I think that's a wicked thing to do.
God shouldn't do that. If God cares about human beings, he should not allow that to happen.
Having discussed the arguments both for and against religion, we turned to speculation as to the reason why so many people still had a need to believe.
I don't think anybody has any very good ideas about why this is, especially why they believe in it to the extent that they do.
What I would speculate about it is, I think it's less to do with the idea of death and survival of death and rewards in heaven and punishment in hell. I think it's a sort of cosmic loneliness. I think that's what's behind it. It's hard for people to accept that we are alone and that nobody cares outside of us. I think there's a kind of constitutive reason for that, which is human consciousness is essentially sealed off from other consciousnesses. Mine has sealed off from you. We only know each other indirectly through the symptoms of the body. And yet we yearn to be in contact with other people. Love is a lot to do with that. So we have this feeling that we are, as conscious embodied beings, somehow or other lonely in our essence, cut off in our essence. And that's a feeling which we struggle against. And you can see it in literature and so on, dealing with this theme. Frankenstein actually deals with it a lot. So we feel this sort of metaphysical existential aloneness in the universe. And God is a wonderful antidote to that, because we, in the case of God, God, we feel, directly comes into our minds, and we're directly in contact with God. See, God doesn't know us through our bodies. God knows us intimately in our minds, and that satisfies a deep craving, I think, in the human soul, right, for communion with something outside the self.
I'd just like to finish with one thing. Here you are, like myself, reluctant to use the word atheist to describe what we are. It's an accusation rather than, as it were, a conviction. In a country which, in fact, has become more intensely religious, do you find it difficult to uphold such ideas in the America of the 21st century?
Let me say something about the first point, the label one has. Yeah, to be called an atheist, it's a negative view, and it suggests that one is a sort of professional atheist. You know, you spend your life arguing against God, which Ray Russell did. And I think that's a sort of an undignified and rather pointless procedure. Once you decide there isn't a God, there's not much point in inveighing against it, unless you think huge harm is being done by the belief in God. But nobody spends their time trying to prove to others that the Greek gods don't exist. You know, you just decide that they don't, and that's the end of the story for you. So I like to distinguish atheism from anti-theism. Anti-theism is opposition to theism. I am an anti-theist because I believe that religion is harmful in human life. So I am an anti-theist. I'm not just an atheist who something my only values are that I don't agree with it. I'm actively opposed to it. But then I distinguish that from what I call post-theism or post-atheism, which is the healthy state of mind where you've put all that behind you. Now, we can't do that yet because there's lots of religion in the world and lots of bad results of it. But to me, the ideal society would be one in which the question of religion didn't really arise for people. Or if it did, it wasn't a heavy question for them. They would say to each other, you know, those humans used to believe back there in 2003. Some of them believed there was this God and he did this. Others didn't, and did TV programs about why they didn't. What a funny debate that was, you know. So it would be a post-theist society where it wasn't an issue.
That wraps up the Colin McGinn interview. I really have to say that there are many things that he has explained that make a lot of sense to me. I don't know about some other people, but it makes a lot of sense to me. And I just believe that he says that he would fight to the death to allow someone to believe in what they want to believe in, even though he is an anti-theist and thinks that it is bad. And I have to say, I don't know one religious person that might say, I would fight to the death to allow someone to not believe in God. So I think he's a rather interesting man, and he has some very valid points. And I would like to, I guess I should ask Jeff if he agrees with mine. Do you agree with that, Jeff?
I am so there, girlfriend.
See, I knew he had the same kind of feelings that I had. But why don't I play this wonderful song, which is by Steve Martin, and it is called Atheists Don't Have No Songs. So let's do this one.
This is the entire atheist hymnal right here. It's a little song called Atheists Don't Have No Songs.
Hallelujahs for the Jews have this heaven, rock of ages, atheists just sing the blues. Romantics play Clair de Lune, or again sing He is Risen, but no one ever wrote a tune, or God to save.
existentialism. For atheists,
there's no good news.
They'll never sing
a song of faith.
In their songs, they have a rule.
The he is always lowercase. The he is always lowercase.
Some folks sing
a bacchantata,
bacchantata.
Leave the rest in Christmas trees. Atheist songs add up to nada,
up to nada.
But maybe we'll have Sunday's free.
Dress up for mass
and listen to Gregorian chants.
Atheists just take a pass,
watch football in their underpants.
Okay, folks, I'm going to have to end this segment, and Jeff has to leave because he can't stay for the Animal Connections, and he just really wanted to say goodnight. Right, Jeff?
Good night, everybody.
Oh, so there he goes, and that will it was nice having him here. And I do want to, though, make sure that I get into the Animal Connections, because, you know, the animals get very... There goes. That is... Okay, Tiggy. So... She said it. So here we go. I want to, for Animal Connections, I would like to read a little clip from Global News from the Best Friends Animal Society magazine in January-February 2011 issue. It's about Romania. I just like to show you all the things that are going on in the world in trying to help animals. There are people all over in the worst countries that care. And in Romania, Dr. Aurelian Stefan drives from village to village in his specially equipped van, spaying and neutering the cats and dogs of Romania and making a big difference to their well-being. Following the disastrous years of the Ceausescu regime, which came to a violent end in 1989, Romania was in shambles and the situation for street animals was dire. Times are still tough economically, and people are grateful for recent efforts made to help the dogs and cats. In the past 5 years, Romania Animal Rescue, which is RAR, has sponsored the sterilization of 8,700 community animals. RAR's goal is to spay or neuter 80% of Romania's street animals to stabilize the animal population. Would you like to know more on that? You can go to www.romaniaanimalrescue.org. And then there was a cute, that was in the Best Friends, January, February 2011. We have here Animal Antics, and this is from March, April 2011, Best Friends. And this is just a cute little story someone sent in from Dawn Franklin, Manassas, Virginia. On Memorial Day weekend, my daughter and I were in a rush getting out two dogs into the car to get to a training session. I got my six-month-old, Sharpei Ming, in the car with me, and while I was waiting for my daughter, I saw the front door opening and the poodle, Moochie, running out. Then my daughter running after her, holding the dogless leash. I quickly ran after the poodle and was able to catch her down the block. Coming back to the car, I found that the doors were locked with Ming inside. Not a problem, I thought. I'll just get my spare keys, but they, too, were in the car. I called the locksmith and found out it would cost $100 for him to come and unlock the car. Fortunately, the car was in the garage and the window was open a crack. Ming sat patiently in my seat, watching everything. I told my daughter to get the dog to unlock the car, but I didn't think Ming would actually be able to do it. My daughter pantomimed unlocking the lock, using her teeth, and standing outside the window opposite the lock. Ming imitated her. So I thought that was really cute. Now, there is something else that I think is really pretty. This is a story in Best Friends. It's in the May-June 2011 issue, and it's called Together Again. And Bosley is a two-year-old husky mix, and he came to Best Friends recently from a hoarding situation. Somewhere along the way, Bosley developed a setback with his self-confidence. And though he's 96 pounds of solid muscle, Bosley would probably scamper away from a squirrel who scowled at him. Bosley escaped his run early on during his stay at the sanctuary, but they found him again, and it was clear he needed to move into a jump run made especially for jumpers like him. So when he had the only thing is he had a low level of confidence, and he had a tough time getting along with the dogs in any of the jump runs. So they saw he was an easy target and started picking on him. But then there was Heidi Lou, a shepherd mix, who was in the first run Bosley lived in, and they really seemed to connect the two of them. So Heidi Lou is a confident dog with excellent social skills, the perfect companion for a guy like Bosley. She was also a bit on the lonely side. Anyway, Bosley and Heidi Lou became instant pals, and Heidi Lou's confidence has rubbed off on Bosley in all the right ways. He used to be so nervous, and now, though, with Heidi Lou leading the way, Bosley is more than happy to go inside and relax as long as she's by his side and she never wants to stray far. He can face the world with a smile. Now, being this was Music Week, what I would like to do is play. I'll be very angry if I don't see it right now. But there is a wonderful song that Thomas Earl, who played Music Week this weekend, and he's this is his song For Always, and it's about two labs, and I'd like to play it. So here goes.
Every time you come around, I can see it in your smile. And every time you come around, I wanna stop the world for a while. 'Cause you know I love you for always. Don't you know that I've been searching for a sign, trying to find a reason, trying to find a rhythm. Every time you come around.
Okay. Now I would like to do my usual and tell you another phrase, that life is bearable when, at the end of the day, you're still healthy, sane, and hopeful. And Chinese cookie wisdom, love is like wildflowers. It is often found in the most unlikely places. I did want to pay tribute to a dear friend of mine that recently passed away. Her name was Irma Brown, and we used to work together many years ago, and she always kept touch lists. 25 years, she never stopped mailing me cards, and we would talk on the phone and have long conversations. And she had a good life. She was 81, but she did die unexpectedly. I have to tell you, I didn't realize how much that, even not seeing her, I just recently got to see her after 25 years, and it was really nice seeing her again. I realized that each year we would talk for maybe 2 hours on the telephone. And very intelligent woman. She used to write poetry, very smart. And she sort of, I guess, was my muse. And I beginning to feel like I didn't realize how much I depended on those. When you have a good connection and you have great conversation, an honest conversation, and you're able to talk about all those things that you feel and all your ideas, and someone understands them, you don't realize until they're gone. So I would like to play at the end, since this is near the end, I'm going to play John Lennon's song, Imagine. It's for Irma. I wish I had seen her before she passed, and it was only recent, the last couple of weeks. I will miss her. So here we go, guys. And remember, next week will be Daniel Dennett. Daniel Dennett is the American philosopher on atheism. And he explains why he called one of his books Darwin's Dangerous Idea, and why many of Darwin's contemporaries in particular considered Darwin's theory of evolution to be dangerous. He goes on to deal with the question of consciousness. Is the consciousness soul distinct from the body? Talking about Darwin's rejection of the soul and the possible origins and psychological purposes of a belief in an immaterial soul. And then he talks about his Christian upbringing and how he became an atheist. And he goes on to ask why it is thought rude to criticize religious belief, and suggests that it is due to the influential status of the religions in question. He finishes by wondering whether we could live effectively in a post-theistic world. That's next week. And now I will end with Imagine. And this is for Irma.
All right, if I can get my finger on the right note. Go into Johnny starting it, and then you can spread it, all right?
Imagine.